So let's, should we start with this question? You want to solve this problem on your own? So the question asked is, if you make a clone, and we do make clones, we are actually making copies of that.
Pardon? Sir, if we make copies, everything should be copied, but the memory and other
areas that
the original person particular is not copied. So we can't say,
you know, forget about copying people. Let's say I am making copies of some other things.
That's what we are having a copy of the book, means the idea is copied.
So that's a way of understanding it. So in that very process, what you are actually doing is, you are not actually copying the thing. So let's look at it from more clear point of view. How are you going to understand this issue? Suppose if you are asked, suppose, let us say, this particular clone has some substance. Let us say it has got a set of carbon molecules. And this is a clone. This one will have another set of carbon molecules. Are you actually talking about the same carbon being there and here? Right? So this is made of similar raw material, but not the same raw material. Similar raw material would mean, like, this clone also has the cells of the similar type. It may also have the genes of the same type. It may also have the molecules of the same type. It may be also behaving the same way, assuming that they will both behave exactly the same way, not a problem. Still, the substance is not a copy of the other substance.
That means information is same.
You may say that. You may say that the form is the same, but substance is different. So when you are saying that something is a copy of the other thing, you are actually saying that they are only same only in the form, they are not same in the content. They are two different individuals. They occupy, in other words, if there are two particulars, they occupy different time and space. If they can't occupy the same time and space. So that's another way of saying that some particular is not the same thing as the other particular. If there is a particular and it occupies the same position and the same space, then you can actually say that I'm actually talking about the same particular. You can do that. Take, for example, such an example can be given from science. You know about Venus? You know about Venus, a planet. Okay. We know about evening star.
Yes.
What is that?
Venus.
You know about morning star.
Yes. Same.
It's also the same. So, but one may have to prove it. How will you prove it? You'll be able to prove it only by showing the time and space of that object being the same. So how will you prove the identity of that? So Venus is a particular object in the cosmos. Same is the case with evening star and the morning star. So how will you resolve this thing? Are they three different things? So evening star is a name, is a proper name. Venus is a proper name. So you give proper names to particulars. You give general names to universals. So that's another way of bringing out. In fact, that's how the grammar came into the picture. So that's the reason why these are so important distinctions that give you a kind of a rules of how to conduct a discourse, how to talk, how to write the rules of grammar, how to say that someone is speaking properly or not. In fact, all these things, if you remember, if you look at this, you will see that most of these things also assume some element of some kind of science that is already assumed when you are constructing the grammar, when you are constructing the subject and the predicate and things like that. Okay, let me make it a little big. Is different, right? The two different particulars.
Yes.
Even if they are exact copies, they are two different particulars. The two different particulars. I mean, that can be said of so many things. Take for example, let us say we have two. I have a car and you have a car. Okay, and both the cars are manufactured, let us say, by the same company. Okay, same model, everything is the same. So it may be the same color, you know, everything is exactly the same. The only difference is the registration number is different, maybe, or the chassis number would be different. So that clearly indicates that there are two different particulars again. So they are occupying two different times and space. They have different substance. So how do you prove possibly that there are two different substances? If you destroy one car, the other car doesn't get destroyed, isn't it? Possible to independently deal with them. You can deal with those two particulars independently of each other. So this is how one can prove that whether they are the same particulars or not. Suppose if one were to dispute that evening star is different from the morning star, suppose somebody, I mean, a very nasty thought though, destroys Venus, then Venus should also get destroyed, morning star also should be destroyed, and evening star also should get destroyed.
So like we copied a book, if we destroy the original,
that is why the copying the book, as in photocopying, actually produces two different particulars.
So the copying the book is also two different particulars.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. It is right. However, there is something that is keeping both the books, saying that, you know, both of them are copies of Plato's Republic, let us say. So we have copied Plato's Republic into two different things. Like we printed Plato's Republic, 500 copies of Plato's Republic have been minted. Now what do you mean by that? The content is still the Republic.
So if the one idea is destroyed, then the idea for all the books are not destroyed.
In the sense that. But then the question again is interesting thing. Ideas are like that. I mean, it's an interesting thing about the ideas is also that you cannot create them, you cannot destroy them either. So in a sense, you know, what you get from that is a strange idea of something like the law of conservation is not applicable to ideas. The law of conservation is not applicable to universals and types. Why? Because it's not matter and energy. If they were made of matter and energy, they would have been substance. They would have been substantial. If they are substantial, they would follow the law of conservation anyway. So what is preventing the particulars from copying from another is the law of conservation. So if you actually look at it seriously, you know, this particular distinction also actually assumes law of conservation implicitly. They may not have spoken about it so clearly, but if you actually read Plato's dialogues clearly, you would see it stated so explicitly. When people are arguing, why do you think that they cannot be copied? In what sense do you think you cannot be copied? Then Socrates comes out and argues with them, saying that, I mean, you cannot copy them for this reason, you cannot copy them for this reason, you can copy them for this reason.
So then if, as you said, animal are universal, how can you copy them?
Do we copy them?
That is the question.
No, we are not actually copying them. We are only copying them in the form, not
yes.
in the content. The content is not copyable as such in the case of an animal. So what you are doing is you are trying to create the same form, but not the same substance. I'll give you another example to convince you of what I mean by this. When I am born as a kid, I am made of, I mean, assuming that I'm using all my understanding of molecular biology, I am born with a set of DNA molecules, a set of protein molecules, and a set of carbohydrate and fat and other kinds of substances, which are in turn made of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and various other things like nitrogen, phosphate, things like that. So that's all the things that I have. But suppose if I ask you this question, do I still have that oxygen atom which my mother gave me? That particular oxygen atom which my mother gave me, do I have it with me today? Do I have with me today the carbon atom which my mother gave me? May or may not. However, the form in which those carbon atoms and the hydrogen atoms and the oxygen atoms got together may still be with me, because the same genes are with me, the same proteins were with me. Even if they made copies of themselves, even if the cells divided themselves and created more cells out of them, from where were those carbons coming from? Where were those oxygens coming from? They came from my food. And the oxygen that my mother gave me must have gone out as oxygen, because I have done respiration on that. Then that oxygen is gone off, that atom is no longer there, but some other atom came and substituted in that place, but the form remained intact. So this gives you a tremendous feeling of what they meant by the non-copyability of particulars. You can substitute them. If you remove it, you put something else there in its place. So in order to keep that life in the same way, what you have to retain, what you have to conserve, is the form of that substance. And that also is another way of convincing you that particulars cannot be copied. You can only copy the form. So if you really want to, for example, make artificial DNA synthesis, for example, so you use DNA synthesis, another copy of DNA is made, number of copies of DNA are made. You also make nowadays artificial copies of insulin molecule, for example. So whenever you are making those insulin molecules, the particular amino acids that get into the making that insulin molecule are different. Though each time you are saying that it is the same alanine that went into it, it's the same glycine that went into it, you might be able to say all those things, but still each of those glycine molecules are different. But all of them are glycine molecules. Why? Because all the glycine molecules are of the same form. The structure of that thing is important. So when we are studying science, what do we study? We study the form. And that's actually one of the reasons why Plato is considered to be the person who defined what is it to do a systematic study of any subject. To study the systematic study of any subject is to understand the form of that subject. So just talking about a single particular will never give you science. So that's the reason why we also consider this as part of history of science, though we don't call, you know, all these people as actually scientists today. I mean, we don't call Plato a scientist, we call them philosophers. But I mean, I call Plato a scientist because he actually did an invention. He did an invention of a very important relation based on which you can construct science, for example, such as genus and species. So if he has not invented and delineated that thing, of course some other person would have invented it, right? And that's the characteristic feature of science. It's not necessary that only Einsteins and Newtons have to create the science. Even if they haven't done it, some other person will come and do it in their place. So that's the interesting aspect about the science. So much about the discussion. But if you still have some more questions, I mean, I have already shown you the way of how to do it. Towards the end of the class, I will exactly show you where to put those questions. Okay, we can do that kind of things later point. So now, this is a picture that we actually drew based on some other pictures that were available. It was on the exhibition. So this actually shows how the four elements that you have in the corners of this, and these are considered to be the four basic properties of the substances, such as you can see, there is opposition here. So now, if you want to, for example, say earth and fire, you know, this particular organization of knowledge, this matrix was created by Empedocles. The credit to draw this diagram was given to Empedocles. So Empedocles drew this diagram, a very interesting diagram if you actually look at it. Earth and fire are dry, and at the same time, earth and water are cold. Water and air are wet. Air and fire are hot. And then he again, you know, makes other substances possible by this kind of compositions. So it is in this space that everything else is composed. And the basic ones are here. So the combination of this will give you this possible space. And the combination of these two will give you this possible space. So this is how, you know, the world of all possible combinations can be made. So that was a kind of an ontology, that was a kind of a worldview that has been made. And this was Empedocles' famous picture, which is highly appreciated for the manner in which, you know, he thought so beautifully. And that's the reason why we have also drawn this picture. Of course, this is our caricature, but this is not exactly the way how Empedocles drew it, possibly. But we don't know exactly, this was the picture that was drawn by Empedocles or something like that, but we see this in Aristotle's books as Empedocles drawing. So exactly where he drew and things like that, we have no idea. Okay, now having said this, now I want to turn to the attention of the topic of the second part today, and that is this picture. So we're going to have a discussion on worldview. What is it to have a worldview? And how important it is for understanding science and also understanding history of science. What is it to have a worldview? What do you mean by having a worldview? We have seen some examples of it already. Suppose if you believe like Heraclitus that everything that is possible or what is there in the world is always a change, then what happens? The world is made of phenomena. The world is made of events. And if someone believes like that, then what happens is that becomes your worldview. That means you always look at the world using that spectacle. like, you know, you wear one particular spectacle, the whole world always looks in that color. So it's like that. So a worldview is like that. In the similar way, Democritus was an atomist. So I drew this picture here, not just for Democritus' worldview, but the worldview of an atomist. Very interesting character of an atomist worldview. Incidentally, also happens to be the modern science view as well. And what is it? If you see the difference, there is an order to it. There is an order in which these are placed. What is the order in which these are placed? Earth, very dense, highly dense. If you, even if you take the view of Anaximenes, the view of condensation and rarefaction. Earth is here, slightly rarefied, which is water, that is less dense, and then air, and then fire, and then space or whatever, just the void, where there is no particle, there is no atom. So this is one kind of a worldview. Now what is the interesting characteristic feature of this worldview? If you have a worldview of this kind, only in such worldviews quantification is possible. If you want to measure something, you measure what? You measure some degree of something, whatever that degree be. Whether it is a degree of distance, whether it is a degree of density, or whether it's a degree of some quality or whatever. So whatever is measurable is always measured. So unless you have created that kind of a dimension of the world, it's not possible to measure anything. So today, if modern science is still accused to be atomistic, it's because of the insistence that quantitative reasoning is important. You have to always think in terms of a quantitative reason, and that's the reason why you have a worldview like this. I will be contrasting this with another worldview. Interestingly, though Aristotle is a very famous scientist, a very famous philosopher, he could not break the ice of science for this reason. He thought of these things as categories. Because he was so influenced by genus species kind of categories that he created. He said that fire is one category out there. It is almost like saying that, you know, while Plato is an atomist, I told you Plato is one of the atomists, and that's why Plato thought there is only one sun on one. Whereas Aristotle has four of them. So if you have to think in terms of Aristotle, you know, you have one summum bonum called fire, another one called air, another one called water, another one called earth, and then a combination of them will lead to everything else in different ways. But each of them is a different substance. You cannot reduce one substance to the other by using any kind of relational properties. So he argued against atomists. In fact, in his book called Physics, he has arguments against atomism. We will be visiting some of those arguments. Not now. We will visit them at the time when Galileo discovers a famous law called the law of free fall. And in fact, Galileo argues against Aristotle to say that if you hold this worldview, you cannot solve the problem of law of free fall. You will be really worried or maybe getting puzzled, what is the connection between the two? And of course, we will see the connection. So, law of free fall can be solved only if your worldview is like this. If your worldview is like this, you will never be able to solve the law of free fall. Why? Because if you are classifying everything into classes and substances, into incomparable things, then you end up discussing something like this. You have one force for speed, you have another force for slowness of motion. So that's how Aristotle thought. Aristotle thought in terms of categories. He said speed is one category, slowness is another category. They are two different things. So when you have, when you see, it's not that Aristotle was not scientific, he was scientific, but then he got stuck with a categorical mind, is a taxonomic mind. He divided everything into, you know, essences, and they separated them, and he said that they are not miscible anymore. So he kept them as separate, and as a result he created so many puzzles and so many things which Galileo said is simply not solvable. This is not the way how we can ever think. If you do like that, you will produce wrong mathematics. He showed that how wrong the mathematics would be if you follow Aristotle, and the mathematics would be perfect if you follow atomist worldview. And that is how he looks at those puzzles. Those puzzles we will get into a little later. Now we will do a little more discussion about these things and trying to see how this issue is actually related to, for example, the law of free fall. We just look at briefly so that you can. So let us keep these things like this. Let us look at Aristotle and see how he would try to see why something, if it is left here, will fall down. You will see how they build a kind of a worldview. Suppose there is a chalk here. Okay. This is chalk. Chalk is made of earth. So I leave it here. Will it fall down? It will fall down, right? So why is it falling down still? Aristotle's explanation was something like this. It will fall down because every substance has a natural place. Every substance has a natural place. The substance, earth, has a natural place here. So what you did, you lifted it, countering the natural place of earth with your hand. You applied some force on it. So this he calls forced motion. What is the forced motion? By taking it from the earth and putting it on top. So what is now, what happened now, you have put it here. You took the earth, the chalk at this place and then left it. It fell down because it has to come here. That is the tendency of that substance, is to go to that, its natural place. And that's why it went there. What if I take some water and take it here? It has to come back. That's why water will fall when there is rain. Now the question would be, if you put a little bit of air and bring it to the earth, what will happen to that? It will go up. This is also true. That means, if you actually look at, he also looked at it, this whole issue so beautifully. So he constructed this whole theory so nicely. It's so coherent. It was impeccable, and people lauded Aristotle's view for 1500 years. And everybody believed Aristotle. There was no disputes. Everybody thought that Aristotle was great. And that's correct. Everybody repeated whatever he said. And in fact, you can see that you take a beaker or put some water in some container. Put a balloon full of air and force it down. What will happen? It will come up. Why do you have to apply force? Aristotle argued. You have to apply force if you take a balloon containing air, and if you have to put it inside water, you have to apply force. Why do you have to apply force? You have to apply force because that is not its natural place. So that means what he said, you apply force only when it is not its natural place. If it is its natural place, you don't have to apply any force, it will automatically go on its own. And that's really true. That's why it made so much sense. People never thought there is any problem there. Actually speaking, there is no problem even now. We can always think about it like that, very nicely. So this is Aristotle's worldview, and using this kind of a worldview, he talked about all kinds of motion that happens in the world. So he is the first person in the whole world to actually ask such paradigmatic questions. In fact, the law of free fall was problematized by Aristotle. Problematized means, he started asking all these questions, which, for example, later on Galileo and Newton have solved these puzzles. He discussed about, for example, friction. He discussed about wheels moving on the surface of the earth, and what is the force. He analyzed those forces into various components, and he looked at what is the force, which of this force is natural, which of the force is artificial. Artificial force would mean that you have to apply. So you apply an artificial force whenever it is against the natural place. So whenever you have to take any of these things against anywhere, you will have to apply this. So he gives you examples of this kind. Why is it that the smoke goes up? We consider smoke as something part of air and fire. It has to go up. Why is the flame always goes up? Why doesn't it go down? Whenever you see a flame, flame always goes up. It will never see an inverted flame. It's impossible to see an inverted flame. Even if you forcibly invert it, you will always see the flames going up like this. Water is falling down on earth because it is air. It is less.
Water is on earth. It goes down. Because there is force.
Why? Why? He gives an explanation to that. He gives explanation to that. Interestingly, why don't you yourself argue like Aristotle now, right now? See, what he is saying is that water goes further down. Why does it go further down? Because by mistake there was air there. See how cogent, it's really such a nice thing. There is air there, air should not be there. And therefore water goes and occupies that place to drive the air out. Because why? If you have an earth, on top of the earth only water can be there. So water went there because that is its natural place. So only another earth could replace that water. And that's why more earth can push that water, and then the water would rise up. Water will come up. So water will come up. So water can be forced down from earth only by earth and not by anything else. And if you actually read physics, it's really a fascinating way how he problematized. So what is the greatness of Aristotle is, the Aristotle is, by asking these questions, by doing science, by focusing your attention on problems like this, he made empirical science possible. He may have given wrong theories. He may have given wrong theories, but these theories were proven false. But he picked up. He found out how to do science. That is by giving you by examples, by looking at problems. So science as a problem solving activity started with Aristotle. He is the one who said, how does a plant germinate? He gave theories about how the germination happens. How does an embryo become big? He actually looked at the embryos. He drew drawings of how the embryos, and some of the drawings were put up on the exhibition there, taken out from his own books. Most of them are burnt. I don't know how people have redrawn those drawings and things like that. But if you actually look at this, he did meticulous studies of all those things. And if you remember, when this guy Alexander was going all around the world. Okay, the teacher had a wish, unlike Ekalavya and Dronacharya. They had a different wish, whereas this Aristotle has a wish. Wherever you go, go and conquer whatever, I don't mind, but you have to always bring me back the flora and fauna of that area. So he has built a big museum, so he used to bring every animal that they killed, you know, and they used to bring the corpse with, filled with other non-material, and then they used to bring that animal. So this is the animal that I found in India. And then, you know, Aristotle created a big museum of all the things. He used to write about the structure of different flowers that they have seen, different things that they have seen. He also sent people, because flowers will disintegrate. That's why Aristotle used to send people who can draw it in front of them. So along with the people who went with the army, they used to go, a lot of people who used to draw the pictures of the animals and plants and the people that they saw. And those drawings went back to Aristotle for investigation. So data collectors. So data collectors went with Alexander's army and who collected all the data for him. Anyway, what is important here is that if you see the kind of you know, beautiful picture that he has drawn about, you know, I'm trying to explain how things happen. One of the interesting things that also interesting here is that why will change happen at all? So for him, for Aristotle, a change will happen in two ways. One is called natural change, the other is called forced change. A natural change is the change that will happen in such a way that it will go towards its natural place. And this is also nowadays called a teleological explanation. A teleological explanation is an explanation where something happens in order to. That means it goes towards some kind of a position. Suppose if you were to explain something like this. Suppose if I tell you, why would elements combine? What would you say? You would say that. But I would say that's a teleological explanation. Why would that be a teleological explanation? Because you say that to achieve stability is the objective of matter. So Aristotle used to give that kind of explanation. That's why they are called teleological explanations. But natural science doesn't give teleological explanation. We give mechanical explanations. So what is a mechanical explanation? Of course, we'll have a lot of examples to see the mechanical explanations. Almost everything that we do nowadays in the name of modern science is mechanical. We don't accept teleological explanations in science for various reasons. So we consider that all the things have to be explained only in terms of mechanical kind of worldview. So in this kind of a worldview, on the other hand, you could still also try to explain, you know, how the, like the same things like, you know, fall of bodies should happen or whatever. They will also be able to be explained. So how would you explain, if you are a Democritus, the fall of an object? Why would an object placed here, and if you leave it, it should fall down?
Denser.
It's more denser. So, why, if it is denser, why should it go down?
Because the air is pushing.
Air is pushing. No, if you, then you are not a Democritus. You are not an atomist. Atomists are not supposed to do anything to do with those things. What is the characteristic feature of
density?
I'll give you an example. According to the atomists, suppose, let's look at this. So this is earth, this is water, this is air, and this is fire. Suppose there is no air. I remove air. What will happen? Suppose if there is no air, what will happen? Does this picture change? If there is no air, does this picture change? Does this picture change?
Yes.
It does. You have only three basic substances. Whereas here, it makes no difference. Why? Suppose there is no earth. Okay. Suppose if there is no earth, there is a kind of a vacuum here, in this case. That substance is not there, but the remaining things are there. Whereas in this case, what happens if there is no earth? Its place will be occupied by water. Water will become the center of the earth. In fact, these are called the thought experiments. These thought experiments, don't think, are done only by Einstein. They were done by Aristotle. They were done by Aristotle as well as Galileo, of course, by various other people. They used to, if you read those old books, you actually see a large number of thought experiments, a lot of reasoning that went into it. They may not have discovered and solved all the problems, but then this is all the history of science that you will find it very, very interesting. So what happens if water is not there? Space will be occupied by air. That gives you a clue of how to understand motion in an atomistic view. Can you solve this problem? Pardon?
Air is loosely bound and earth is tightly bound. So that can go into
the tightly bound and loosely bound cannot be articulated properly. Because an atomist, remember, is a person who is not concerned about substance. He is concerned about relation. It is a relation between the substance that matters. I can't hear.
Denser matter.
Uh-huh. Did you hear what he said? So, I'm sorry, you need to say
denser
speak loud.
A denser material might have strong attraction with the denser material.
Okay, you're proposing that there is some kind of attraction between for the denser material.
Denser.
So denser material will have attraction.
With denser. Yes, sir, with denser, more attractive. As compared to the
As compared to the
with the same as Aristotle.
No. He is proposing that denser will attract to denser and less
denser will attract denser.
More flexion as compared to the less denser.
Less denser.
Yes. So it compares.
So you need one more hypothesis. I mean, you have to assume that there is something called attraction.
Relation, sir. That is a relation only.
Attraction is not a relation, right? It's a force.
Then
Aristotle has a natural place. But for these people, there should not be any natural place.
Yes. This
is a tight relationship. Okay. I mean, welcome. I mean, think about it. I mean, this is how you have to solve problems. I mean, I'm giving you some constraints. I mean, you should not be thinking like that, but you should be thinking like this, and you still solve the problem. How will you think about it? You already know the you have the background. You have heard about these things elsewhere. You are not trying to bring them here because I said worldview. I mean, suddenly you are confused. Well, what is the worldview to do with all these things? This worldview is called relativistic worldview. Why is it relativistic worldview? And this is not relativistic worldview. This is called categorical thinking. There is no relativism here. It's all essences. So why is the rabbit? Because it's a rabbit. Because it's an animal. Why is a tree like this? Because it's a tree. It's a vegetable. In other words, I mean, it shouldn't hurt you. It's like this. You are a Muslim because you are Muslim. You are Hindu because you are Hindu. This is a categorical way of looking at things. You look at people as different. You look at things as different. You know, you look at the world as different. You create, you know, compartments in the world. Scientists don't do that compartmentalization, because they are, what did they say? That if there is anything, it's all physical, and if there is a cause, it has to be physical, and you have to look at everything as one. You cannot accept so many partitions. All of them are of course physical. Even Aristotle said that there are physical, but then he said there are four different physical substances, but then atomists are not agreeing to that kind of thing. So relativistic way of looking at the world doesn't accept. In fact, you know, as you can see, void is such an important thing for atomism. And as you know today, most of this space is void. Even in an atom, you know, not even 1% of it is a substance. Most of it is empty space. That's why modern science fits so nicely with this kind of picture. In fact, when Aristotle argued against atomism, he argued because void is absurd. He argued how void leads you to mathematical puzzles. He argued that void leads to mathematical puzzles, and in fact he uses mathematics to show that it leads to, it's such an absurdity, because it made him to divide something with zero. He showed that dividing some number with zero is absurd, and you would end up to that kind of things. We will see exact problem in the way how it was resolved by Galileo. We will look into that later, but then that's the way how we look at it. Now you still have to convince me about how the things would fall in this kind of situation. I'll give you a clue. Archimedes. I'll use a word called Archimedes.
Yeah.
So use Archimedes' law of floating bodies to solve this problem. So what they did when they were looking at this kind of thing, so they used essentially, if you are an atomist and you have to follow the, understand the law of free fall and things like that, you would do it on the basis of the difference, the relative difference, on basis of, you know, so like how much matter in how much volume. And then you just argue on the basis of that. So Galileo begins his arguments like that against Aristotle, and he gives beautiful examples of how to conduct this kind of thing. Suppose if you put water in earth, where would it come up? So he gives examples of this kind, saying that, you know, this is exactly the way how it happens. He says it's basically that the ash, actually speaking, there was water and earth sunk towards the center. So gives that kind of an example. They're actually showing that this is actually relative densities. So by giving the argument in terms of relative densities, he tries to show how everything would be falling out there. And there he says that the forced motion and the, you know, the different kinds of motions that you have are actually nothing but are due to the difference in the medium. So motion happens whenever you put some substance in a different medium. So if you put some substance in a different media, then if there is a change in the density, there would be some motion anyway. So this is how Galileo began his work on the subject of motion. Though he doesn't remain there over a period of time, it takes about 30 to 35 years of reasoning, and finally he throws away his own theories and finally says that I don't need all these explanations, and gives mechanical explanations towards it. And so so now at the end, what you can actually look at, some of the interesting points that we need to look at is, like, one of the things is the importance of holding on to a worldview. What happens if you hold one worldview to a person who believes in particular worldview? What he does is that whatever happens, he tries to be consistent to that worldview, and he tries to continuously argue and look at everything using only that particular worldview. So worldview is a kind of a spectacle that you wear, and through which you look at the world. Then the whole world looks in a particular way. And suddenly you remove these glasses, you know, and take one more spectacle, and then you look like an atomist. The whole world will be different. It's almost like, you know, it depends on how you look at the world, it looks different. So what kind of theories you have? So you can say that, you know, this is one model, one theory, and this is another theory. And if you change your theories, you look at the world differently. And this is also the point that we discussed right in the first class about how science gives you a kind of a interpretative spectacle to the world. The theories are like, they provide you with interpretations. You give different interpretations to different things. And the various phenomena that happen in the world. And what theory you would propose depends on what kind of model, what kind of a worldview you have. So different people will come out with different worldviews. And sometimes you'll also see some such instances even in among scientists. Even scientists would come out with different points of views. So it all depends on what they think is the most important belief that they have. Suppose if you still believe that, you know, substances can be converted to some other substances, then you would still be looking for some kind of a alchemist kind of belief, wherein, you know, you wanted to convert air into gold and become rich. So if you want to become rich, all that you have to do is, you know, find out a mechanism by which you can convert a useless substance like the garbage, and convert garbage into gold, and then we'll have very beautiful gold to live. Because there will be no garbage, because you have already discovered a way of converting garbage into this thing. Then the slum dogs will become very nice. So that's the kind of model that you would go. So it depends on, you know, how you look at the world and the way how you carry on with these things. Okay, so there are lots of things that you can possibly look at. Some of the things I think you have already seen possibly at the this particular thing that I am showing you is a book that is made out of the exhibition that we have. So that exhibition was made so many years ago, about 5-6 years ago. And we did that exhibition keeping in view that people need to know about the history of science. So we have put together a lot of things. In order to make it interesting, we have drawn so many pictures, so that you know, through pictures people can find. So there is very little text, so it is important for all of you to read and go through the most of the exhibition. And this exhibition, this book will be given to you. For example, the kind of exams that I conduct, suppose if you have to do a midsem, so what I would possibly do is I will give you some printed copies of this, or maybe some from some other book. I'll give you the book, and I will give the question also. So what you have to do is you have to answer that question by going through that material. And that material will not only be given only during the examination, it will be given prior to the examination. That is, you will be asked to read that book. It's in other words, all that I am saying is that you will be given open book examinations. But let me tell you, people fail even in those exams. So don't take these exams lightly. So because the questions then would be of different kind. Okay, it will not be like, you know, by looking at this, no, I am not going to ask. Okay, so like something like this. Don't expect a question like this. What were the times when Tales was born and died? If I ask that question, I mean, you can easily find that kind of an answer. Because the book contains that answer, you will go and find out where the bold letters were. You will look for numbers in the thing and then find out those things and then fill it up. Such questions will not be asked. So don't worry about that kind of questions. Also, you should be looking at it. So I gave you one assignment already. Did I give you one assignment?
Yes.
What was that?
Interpretation.
No, that was not the one. Today morning I gave you
Zeno paradox.
Zeno's paradox was one of the things. So the other the other question I am giving you is this one. So today we have two questions. Very simple. So easy for you to do. You should not use trigonometry to solve this problem. You have to do exactly the way how they did at that time without trigonometry. Just by pure geometrical argument. What was this? The thing that was there is estimating an unknown quantity from a known quantity is the method of science, right? That we always do. Even now algebra is all about that. Estimate unknown quantity from a known quantity. This is a very famous example of Greek this thing. So what happened? It was Thales who solved this thing. Given the height of a pole, I can measure the height of a pyramid. So if you want, read about how Thales did this, solve this, whatever. Now you have to, each of you have to write a separate solution
on paper
and give it to me. And this one as well as the Zeno's paradox. So there are two.
Paradox of doing paper.
Whichever way, you see, I told you, you have three choices. You have three ways in which you can submit answers to me. One, by writing it on the website. Two, by sending me an email. Three, by writing it on a piece of paper and giving it to me. The choice is given to you because you suppose if you don't have a computer, you know, you should not say that, you know, I have been very unfair to you. You know, you have forced me to put it on the thing. If you have no internet, then you know you should not have give me an excuse saying that, you know, since the internet connection was not working, I am not submitting the assignment or something like that. So I am giving you all the three options. Whichever works for you, do it.
Which paradox follows?
Geno.
So only one paradox is zero.
No, there are so many paradoxes.
So we should.
There is one famous Geno's paradox. You will find out what it is. It's a very interesting paradox. It's about a tortoise that is, you know, walking slow, and another athlete who is running fast, and he tries to prove that, you know, it's very difficult for you to determine who is going to win the race.
Yes, sir. Tortoise.
The half distance. Half distance.
Yes.
That was a famous Zeno's paradox.
Yes, sir.
And it was actually an interesting mathematical line of thinking. And so why was it a paradox is the thing that you have to write about. So what was it? There may be other Zeno's paradoxes which you may be also writing about. And the other assignment is this one. Okay, without using trigonometry and all those other modern mathematics, okay, you have to do it the way how Thales has solved this problem. Okay, so we'll stop here. And remember, next time if there is any inconvenience that you feel in campus, okay, call me at 107. Okay, or you can also call Savita madam. You know her number?
Yes.
Yes.
What's her number? So keep those numbers. Okay, keep those numbers with you, because I think next time we are going to solve the problem. Like, you are not going to have that kind of problem again. Last I told him to open this room at 9:15, because sometimes you come early. Okay, you should have this room open by 9:15 all the time. Okay, so that that kind of inconvenience you should not have. If you have any other issues, you can always either write to me or call me or do whatever. Okay, and I haven't seen enough questions. And thanks for all of you who have started using the portal, and there are some questions. There are also some replies to them, and I will also join there very soon. I'll towards this week I will also write my replies to some of those questions that were asked. So you'll find me there very soon there. Ah, right. Okay. I'm sorry about that. This is one of the things that I wanted to do. All right. Where is this site? Okay. Alright. So if I log in, you may not see the way how I see the site. So I want one of you to log in here. So can any of you come and log in? You have an account? So now just see, let's say go to lectures. Okay, I have put the audio files here. Okay, so open one of the files, one of the objects, let's say lecture 1, lecture 0. Click on assignments. So try to organize your questions. Don't write it on the first page, all the questions. Okay, here, click on the assignment. Okay, again, you can actually put your assignments also right there. So, in case you want only me to see the responses and not your colleagues, in case, I mean, you just have that, I mean, I leave it to you entirely.
Yes.
Then what you have to do is, don't publish, keep it private. Okay, there are two options you must have seen when you are writing something. The two options, one is private and the other is publish. You want to check?
Yes.
So, do something. Test assignment maybe. Submit a test assignment, so add comment. Actually, you know, there is another way how you can always submit it. Click on Mehasi. Click on Mehasi. Yeah, you just click on it. Now, right now, you just click on Mehasi. That's the easier way of submitting. You can, because somebody said that, you know, you can't, this is your dashboard.
Dashboard.
Yeah. This is your dashboard.
Yeah.
So, essentially means that, you know, these are the places. Go down. Okay, these are the various things that sort of happened. So what you can actually do is, you can go to personal, what is it, preferences, change password. So what you can, there is a way how you can actually add content to. Okay, you don't have the add content form here, is it? What I'll do is, I'll try to solve this problem. Right now you can use comments box. I will add one more feature here so that you will get add file option. So when you have add file option, not add file, it would be add content or something like that. So then you can add your own pages. And whatever files you are adding, I'll be able to see them. And if you publish it, others also will be able to see those things. Okay, so right now, don't put everything into one place. Go to the proper lecture, and then if you have a questions related to that lecture, put them there, in that place. If you have a general question, I mean, you can just send a general question by just writing a document. Just write some question as a question or something like that, and then put it together. Basically, that all the paperwork that we are doing or whatever things, if it is all recorded at one place, it will help you eventually to resolve many of these issues. Sometimes the questions that you are asking are very important. Then I would be able to modify my lectures next time based on those questions and things like that. So it will help me also in that kind of feedback. Any other doubts related to the site?
Yes, sir. Huh? Sir, after writing one comment, you can edit it.
You can edit your own comment. But the best thing to do is add a more comment and refer to that comment. That is much better. Like a threaded discussion. Like you have said something like this. Suppose you want to change it. You can say what you want to change in that. You can say that. Okay, now I change my response. Now this is the way how I want it to be. And you can write it as another post. That is much better. That way what happens, the entire history is always kept intact. That is much better. All right? Okay. I'll log out to this.